Well, when Francis Ford Coppola was making the movie Apocalypse Now, he worried that he was failing. And he began to hope for a graceful way to bow out from finishing the film. In fact, he even envisioned a scenario in which he would be paralyzed so that he wouldn't have to finish the film. He thought it was an important topic, Vietnam, and being paralyzed was a more pleasing option than actually finishing the film and producing a failure. So he was terrified of failure. And we fear failure as well, don't we? We fear failure as if it were the worst thing that could happen. We take great pains to make sure that failure doesn't happen. When we do fail, we then beat ourselves up mercilessly so that we won't fail again. And we take this attitude toward failure and success and we bring it with us into our life of faith. And then following Jesus becomes this grand effort not to fail. Jesus, however, is not put off by our failure. He expects our failure. One might even say that he delights in our failure because failure represents an opportunity. Peter, perhaps his closest disciple, failed. What failed more than Peter, in fact, was Peter's concept of what it meant to follow Jesus. When he failed, Peter wept bitter tears. But the tears were simply part of the spiritual formation that Peter had to undergo. Failure for us, then, is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to find out who Jesus is. It's an opportunity to find out who we are. And it's an opportunity to find out what it really means for us as individuals to follow Jesus. Last week we looked at the Passover and how Jesus redefined the Passover meal, instituted the Lord's Supper. I hate to do this to you, but we're going to skip over Gethsemane. There's only so much we can cover in Gethsemane. Jesus is strengthened by prayer. He finds the will of the Father, and then the Jewish leaders arrest Jesus in Gethsemane. And we pick up a story in Matthew chapter 26, verse 57. Please turn with me there. Matthew chapter 26, verse 57. This is one of my favorite narratives in all of the Gospels. It's a brilliant narrative whereby Matthew interweaves some things to show us that two trials are going on. I'll give you a few minutes to get there. Matthew chapter 26, verse 57. Well, let's look at the first two verses that set up this beautiful narrative. Verse 57. Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome. Okay, here's what Matthew does. He sets the stage for these two trials. The two chief characters are Jesus and Peter. First, he's going to go into the trial of Jesus. Then he's going to go into the trial of Peter. And it's an entirely different kind of trial for Peter. Well, Peter right now is following Jesus, but at a distance. And he is following in order to see the outcome. You see, things haven't turned out the way Peter expected them to. He expected a triumphant Messiah. And Jesus is not looking like that right now. His vision of what it means to be the Messiah has taken a major hit. And so he follows Jesus, but at a distance, and he wants to see the proceedings, and he is still hoping that Jesus will be vindicated or will somehow defeat these Jewish leaders. So he's close enough to see the outcome, but he's far enough away to make a break for it if the outcome turns out to be unfavorable. From time to time, our vision of what it means to follow Jesus also takes a hit. We too, at such times, are inclined to keep our distance from Jesus, afraid that he might lead us to some place that could cause us harm. And so what we do is we, in like vein, we try to predetermine the outcome. If there's some situation that might be difficult, we want to analyze it thoroughly. We look at it from all sides. We circle around it. Then we circle back again. We want to make absolutely sure that this place is going to be safe before we enter into it. We want an ironclad guarantee that we are not going to get hurt. But we know, of course, that there are no guarantees. Therefore, we become tentative, like Peter. Perhaps we are not even sure what's true anymore. We become frustrated with ourselves. Such times then present themselves as an opportunity for us to face reality, to understand what's really true, to enter the real world, to find out who Jesus really is. Well, let's look at the trial of Jesus, first of all, beginning in verse 59. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath, by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. Literally, Jesus said, "You said." "But I say to all of you," the entire Sanhedrin, "in the future," or literally from now on, "you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his robes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" "He is worthy of death," they answered. Then they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Christ. Who hit you?" So here we have the Jewish leaders who have put Jesus on trial. And we might ask ourselves, what particularly is their problem with Jesus? Well, let's see if we can reconstruct the historical situation a little bit. There are two major parties in Jerusalem and in Judea at this time. There are the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and you've probably heard their names bandied about. The Pharisees were opposed to Roman occupation, so they were in favor of resistance to Roman occupation. The Sadducees, on the other hand, these were the aristocrats. They were in power. They were wealthy. And they collaborated with Rome. So they favored Roman occupation insofar as it served their interests so that they could remain in power. So they were interested, the Sadducees were, in the status quo. Now, the Sanhedrin is made up mostly of Sadducees. The chief priests were Sadducees. And so the Sanhedrin then was very interested in the status quo, although the Pharisees and others were kind of constituted a political pressure group to try to bring their opinions to the fore, and they had some influence as well. The Pharisees were extremely popular with the people. The Sadducees were not quite so popular. So what Jesus did is he opposed the resistance movement, so he upsets the Pharisees, but he stirs up the people, so he upsets the Sadducees. He really upset all of the leaders because he took on the sacred symbols of Israel, and he redefined them, and he replaced them with himself. Chiefly, he takes on the symbol of the temple, and he replaces the temple with himself. So all of these leaders would have thought that Jesus was a false prophet who was leading Israel astray. Now, lest we cast stones at these particular people, we must be very careful in understanding how Matthew is telling the story. He is not telling the story of the failure of the Jewish leaders. He is telling the story of the failure of Peter. Now, the church throughout history has not always seen it that way. We would do well, then, to find ourselves here as the church, as disciples. There's only one disciple in this story. It is Peter. We would do well to identify with him and not cast stones at the Jewish leaders, and certainly not any Jews of any day. What the Jewish leaders are after is finding evidence that is going to convict Jesus in two spheres, the Jewish sphere and the Roman sphere. First of all, they have to find something that is going to get the crowds on their side. Jesus has been popular with the crowds, so they need to convict him of Jewish law, convict him of some slight against Jewish law. And they also somehow have to present him to Rome as a threat. Rome is not going to get too excited about someone who is just simply breaking Jewish laws. So they are willing to entertain false witnesses, but later two witnesses come forward. And although they've jumbled things up a bit, what they say has a ring of truth to it. Jesus has talked about the destruction of a temple. What they are invoking is probably from John chapter 2, where Jesus was talking about the temple of his body and how that would be, if you destroy this, then I will be raised again. He was talking about his resurrection. Nevertheless, Jesus has pronounced judgment on the temple. He has proclaimed himself to be greater than the temple, and he is going to rebuild the temple in a spiritual sense with living stones of men and women who follow him. Now, let us try to understand how the words of Jesus might have impacted these Jewish leaders. And I'm going to use an analogy here, and don't take this as a one-to-one analogy all the way, so please don't misunderstand me, but I'm trying to help us to understand how these people would have felt. We might imagine somebody prior to September 11th, 2001, standing up as a prophet-like figure and proclaiming God's judgment on America, and going and standing in front of the World Trade Center and proclaiming God's judgment on the World Trade Center and that the World Trade Center will be destroyed, this symbol of American capitalism. And then that person goes to the Pentagon and stands before the Pentagon, this symbol of American power, and says, this building is going to be destroyed. And then that same person goes and he stands before the White House, this symbol of American democracy, and he says, this building is going to be destroyed. God is going to judge America. How would American leaders respond to that, assuming that this man was taken seriously? Not too kindly. The Jewish leaders also did not take kindly to someone who talked about God's judgment on Israel and that the sacred symbol of Israel, the temple, was going to be torn down and that in Jerusalem not one stone was going to be left upon another. So what we have here in these proceedings is something that is offensive to Jews and also something threatening to Rome. When you talk about destroying sacred symbols, you are creating a bunch of unrest and making people unhappy and losing the peace. Also, it was kings who built temples. It was kings who restored temples. There was a strong connection between kings and the temple. And particularly the Messiah, the one who was going to come, was expected to restore the temple. Again, you can present him as a king now who is a threat to Rome. Well, how are we to understand the silence of Jesus in the face of these charges? First of all, it's the fulfillment of prophecy. Jesus is like a lamb who is silent before his shearers. That's from Isaiah chapter 53, verse 7, and Jesus is fulfilling the role here of the servant of the Lord. He also believed that it was his vocation to die, particularly after Gethsemane. He has embraced this, and so he's not about to defend himself in order to get off the hook. And third, these people really aren't interested in the truth anyway, so why bother? Jesus is silent. So the high priest senses an opening. He says, are you the Christ? Are you the Son of God? The Son of God would have been a kingly designation, meaning, are you the Christ? Now we have a question that Jesus can speak to. He is going to go to his death as the Christ. His answer is a qualified yes. One of his favorite expressions in these proceedings, you said, meaning that you, Caiaphas, have answered your own question. The answer is yes. However, you have no idea what it means. Jesus then proceeds to tell Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin what exactly it means for him to be the Messiah. And in this, he turns the tables on them. These men are judging Jesus, and now Jesus turns the tables, and he becomes the judge. And the judges become judged. And he invokes two key enthronement texts from the Old Testament, Daniel 7 and Psalm 10, 1. Now in Daniel, the Son of Man, who is the representative of God's people, he rises above the beasts, and the beasts would be the pagan nations, and he comes up to the Ancient of Days, that is God, and he receives an everlasting kingdom. And Jesus, in invoking this imagery from Daniel chapter 7, is saying in so many words, you, the members of the Sanhedrin, are like the beasts. You have become like the pagans, and I am going to rise above you. And you can do whatever you want in your makeshift courtroom, but in God's courtroom, I will be vindicated, and I will be sitting in authority over the whole world, including, of course, you. And he says, literally, from now on, you will see this. From now on, you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. So I don't think Jesus is referring to the distant, far off second coming. He is saying that something is happening right now and something will happen in the immediate future by which you will be able to see, the evidence will be there, that the Son of Man has been vindicated. They can see it right now, in fact, if they will open their eyes, because Jesus has turned the tables on them and become the judge. They will also be able to see it in the amazing growth of the church in Jerusalem and in Judea and really in the whole world, despite all odds. And they will be able to see it in the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, which Jesus predicted. No wonder Caiaphas tears his robes. He says, this is blasphemy. And in his mind, Jesus, in placing himself alongside God, enthroned next to God, this claim constitutes blasphemy. And what Caiaphas has really is more than what he had hoped for. He's got evidence that he hopes is going to convince the Jewish crowds and also the Romans. Well, the Sanhedrin now mocks the authority of Jesus, and the Sanhedrin also mocks him as a prophet. If he really were a prophet, he would be able to say who is hitting him. Jesus has prophesied his vindication, and they mock his authority. He should be able to prevent this treatment of him if he really is who he says he is. If he really is the Messiah, certainly these people wouldn't be treating him this way, and he would be able to stop it. The word slap is used here. It's the exact same word that Jesus used in Matthew 5:39. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other cheek also. Here Jesus is practicing what he preaches. He is fulfilling the vocation of Israel. Well, according to Luke, it looks as if Peter is able to see this. He has followed Jesus as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and if he is able to see this, he would be horrified by what he is seeing. His vision is that of a triumphant Messiah, and this is anything but a triumphant Messiah, as Jesus is being beaten up by these people. So for Peter, involvement with people as a follower of Jesus is going to look completely different than what he expected it to look like. I think also for us, involvement with people as followers of Jesus looks different than what we expected it to look like. And it continues to look different than what we currently expect it to look like. Not that long ago, I noticed a common theme in my fantasies or my daydreams. And it had to do with where people were in my daydreams. If they were there, they were meeting all of my needs. They were either there meeting all of my needs, or they weren't there at all. I was just enjoying myself, reading a book someplace, or overlooking the Mediterranean in some Italian villa, and there was nobody else around. That's the way we think, but it's really different from that. Jesus wants something different for us. I remember hearing a missionary from South America saying once when he first went, I wanted to work with a big tribe. God wanted me to work with a small tribe. It looked different. Following Jesus for that man looked different than what he expected it to look like. So that's the trial of Jesus. Let's pick up the trial of Peter in verse 69. Now Peter was sitting out in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him. You also were with Jesus of Galilee, she said. But he denied it before them all. I don't know what you're talking about, he said. Then he went out to the gateway, where another girl saw him and said to the people there, this fellow was with Jesus of Nazareth. He denied it again with an oath. I don't know the man. After a little while, those standing there went up to Peter and said, surely you are one of them, for your accent gives you away. Then he began to call down curses on himself, and he swore to them, I don't know the man. Immediately a rooster crowed. Then Peter remembered the word Jesus had spoken. Before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. And he went outside and wept bitterly. So we have two trials once again. In the first trial, the charges were against Jesus, and he did not deny the charges. In the second trial, Peter denies the charges against him that he is a follower of Jesus, even though those charges are true. In the first trial, they are looking for false evidence against Jesus. In the second trial, Peter himself offers the false evidence. In the first trial, there were two witnesses. In the second trial, there were also two witnesses, these two servant girls. In the first trial, the high priest tried to compel Jesus to take an oath. In the second trial, Peter volunteers an oath. In the first trial, the high priest stood up right before he rendered his verdict. And in the second trial, these people who are standing around, literally, they render the verdict. They believe the testimony of the servant girls. And they convict Jesus. And they say he is a follower of Jesus. In the first trial, there was a prophecy. Jesus predicted some things. He predicted what would happen to him as the Son of Man. And they say, well, you can't be a prophet. And in the second trial, a prophecy of Jesus comes true, that Peter would deny Jesus. So Peter here is on trial as a follower of Jesus. What's perhaps even more on trial from Peter's perspective as a disciple is his concept of following Jesus. I think he's doubting now whether this cause is worth dying for. I don't think it's so much a failure of nerve. I don't think it's so much a failure of courage. Peter was in the garden. We know that he was the one from John who took out the sword and struck the ear of the slave of the high priest. So I don't think he has all of a sudden lost his courage. I think he has all of a sudden seen that this looks like a bad ministry to get involved with. And this can't be worth dying for. So now the charges against him, as they get more specific, his denials get more intense, and he moves himself out to a safer place, into the gateway. And right in mid-denial, something interrupts him. A rooster crows. And he knows that a higher court has rendered its verdict. And the higher court says, in the first trial, Jesus is the Christ. And in the second trial, Peter, you actually are a follower of Jesus. You see, Jesus had told Peter, before a rooster crows, you will deny me three times. And Peter, of course, from Matthew 16, was supposed to deny himself. Deny yourself. Take up your cross. Follow me. Instead, he denies Jesus. In the first trial, Jesus owned up to the charges and got beaten up for it. In the second trial, Peter gets out of Dodge. What's he thinking now? He has questioned whether Jesus is the Christ, even though earlier he came to that conclusion. But if Jesus could predict his actions so exactly, how could he not be the Christ? And so he does one thing positive here. He stops denying that he is a follower of Jesus. He is a follower of Jesus, and he cannot effectively deny it. Two servant girls have said he's a follower of Jesus. The bystanders have convicted him and said he's a follower of Jesus. And even the blasted rooster says he's a follower of Jesus. And so he weeps bitter tears. And in his words, in Matthew's description of his words, we hear echoes of Zechariah 12:10. And I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and supplication. They will look on me, the one they have pierced, and mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, and grieve bitterly for him as one grieves for a firstborn son. Peter has tried to be someone he is not, and it has not worked. There is a harsh reality he has to face. He is a follower of Jesus, but it looks different from what he thought it would look like. With his previous outlook on life, Peter does not have what it takes to follow Jesus in this new reality. So I submit to you, brothers and sisters, that Peter had to fail. It was necessary for him to fail. His worldview was inaccurate. It had to crumble. He had to fail. And so he weeps bitter tears. But as he weeps these bitter tears, he is being prepared. He is being prepared to follow Jesus in this new reality. And Peter is a broken man. He is exactly the kind of person that God is looking for. Exactly the kind of person that Jesus wants. And so the tears of Peter's biggest failure serve to water the seeds of his discipleship. Now, brothers and sisters, fellow followers of Jesus, I believe that sooner or later, Peter's story becomes our story. We too face similar crises in identity when our version of what it means to follow Jesus fails. Oh, we feel fine in the courtyards of our lives, so to speak, but then the truth closes in, and we become anxious like Peter did, and we tend to move to a safer place. We distance ourselves from Jesus, afraid of what he might ask for us, afraid of where he might want us to go. But if we are followers of Jesus, like Peter, we cannot effectively deny who we are. And we will feel as if we are living in two worlds, and we won't be able to compensate for the incongruity. And then one day, the rooster crows, so to speak. You hear something, you see something, you feel something, something from your past comes back to you. You're shattered in some way. An internal crisis takes place, and maybe you're not sure what's real anymore. Perhaps tears flow. And as the tears flow, there is a release of sorts. That which is unreal slips from your hands. And now you know that you are where you shouldn't be. And you know that Jesus is leading elsewhere and that you must follow him there. We find out who Jesus is. We find out who we are. We find out what it means for us to follow him. Peter found out, didn't he? Right? You know the rest of the story. That beautiful scene at the end of the Gospel of John, John chapter 21, where Jesus makes breakfast for Peter on the beach and he puts Peter back together again. And then what happens in Acts chapter 2? In Jerusalem, this very city, what does Peter do? Luke tells us that Peter took his stand in that city. He preached a sermon about Christ. 3,000 people came to faith in the Messiah. Acts chapter 4, Jesus is arrested by the Sanhedrin, these very men, the men that he ran away from. He's brought to them to face charges. And Luke tells us that the Holy Spirit filled him and that he boldly spoke about Jesus to these men. So, what is the charge against us? In this story, if you are a follower of Jesus, what is the charge against you? You're a follower of Jesus. Guilty as charged. It's who you are. You are a follower of Jesus. And if you are a follower of Jesus, you cannot effectively deny who you are. You can try, but you won't feel good about it. And you have to fail. It is necessary for your version of what it means to follow Jesus to fail so that you can see Jesus for who he is. The tears then, our tears, the tears of our bitter failures serve to water the seeds of our discipleship. And Jesus, of course, sees each tear that falls. We find out who Jesus is. We find out who we are. We find out what it means for us to follow Jesus. May God pour out his spirit of grace and supplication on us in our age so that we might mourn our failures to follow Jesus and that we might find pride and pretense melted away by our bitter tears. We're going to do one more song, Step by Step, again. So Cliff and the band, would you come up? And we need to understand as we sing this song, this expresses a certain confidence that Jesus is going to lead and we are going to follow. And I think that's true. Sometimes we have to fail, though, to get to that point where we can see where Jesus is leading and when we, in fact, are able and willing to follow.